Hello, and welcome again to Outrageous, our weekly podcast where we talk about culture, media, race, politics, and everything in between. Again, I am joined by my two very best friends, Jason, a beatbox extraordinaire from in Washington, D.C. Jason.
Thank you, and I appreciate that introduction because I think we do need to do a little hip-hop tribute at some point during this conversation.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about that. And from my jet setting around the globe is Trisha. Today, from Miami, Trisha is enjoying some tennis, and she's a natural hair enthusiast. Trisha.
Hello.
How are you? Trisha, how's Miami?
It's really early right now, so I'm not feeling it. I'm sort of gritty right now, but yeah. I'm sure I'll get better.
People should know that Trisha in the morning is super gritty, super gritty. I think
I don't know
when the call started before the recording started. What did you say? You guys are both assholes. Like that was out the gate.
Yeah, that was the first sentence. Good morning to you too, Trisha. Good to hear you too.
Not even. She's like, ugh, you guys are assholes. Like,
I don't even know if I can't remember the last time I used the word asshole.
As Kanye West once said, that's a pretty bad way to start a conversation.
Oh dear Lord! When we start quoting Kanye,
I was just gonna say.
I know. When we start quoting Kanye West, there could only be. You know what, Kanye? Can I tell you, though, I'm not necessarily a Kanye West person. I mean, I can quote a couple lyrics here and there, but ever since he went on Twitter, I feel like I know him way too well, and I'm just like, I need less of Kanye West.
Isn't that kind of anybody who goes on Twitter?
I don't think you even need to go on Twitter. Anyone who pays attention to the news knows Kanye West way too well.
But you know what? I have to say props to him for always being good at getting free advertising.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's very good at that.
Yeah. But he's not selling anymore. Like,
anytime his album is about to drop, he always creates a sort of social space where things are going wrong in his world, and then it's being covered on the news, and I keep thinking to myself, wow, what wonderful free advertising.
Hey,
it's on par with Donald Trump.
I was going to say he should run for president.
Like, Didn't he say he was? Yes. He said he was in 20-something, right?
When he said that, it was still very much a pipe dream that a very popular and rich celebrity could run away with an election. So maybe now that this has happened, him, Alec Baldwin, any of these idiots can come out of the run for president. It's open field. Open field. You know what? Before we jump into topics, I just want to talk about my man crush.
Oh, God. Who's this?
Listen, I am in love with Trevor Noah from The Daily Show.
Really?
I think me and him should get married. What do you think?
Well, don't do it in Georgia.
Well... or North Carolina.
Wait, I don't. Oh boy! You still call it a man crush when you're gay? Isn't it just a crush?
Exactly, dude.
Like
if you were crushing on a woman, no?
Yeah, you could have a woman crush. That's a strange term for you to say.
I guess. Oh, Jason would have a man crush.
Yeah, I would
have
a man crush.
Yes. You're just living your normal life.
I'm just living my normal gay life, which will certainly be illegal in certain southern states.
Crushing on men.
He's just so cute. I don't know how he got that job, but thank God he did. I just like to look at him. He's very handsome and funny.
What did he do recently to generate this sort of...
He's on the Daily Show every day. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he's been there forever.
When did you realize? What initiated the crush all of a sudden?
This week,
No, my office mate is constantly watching YouTube videos. I just outed him as not doing any work.
I was going to say,
oh my gosh.
Wow.
Oh, dear.
Wow.
My office mate is constantly watching YouTube videos, so Trevor Noah is, like, always in my office. So.
Okay. That makes sense. Got it.
Yeah, there we go. All right, so enough of you fools. Let's talk about really serious shit. So I'm very sensitive to the fact that I usually peg Jason to go first.
Oh, Lord.
Then and he complains about it. So
I appreciate your sensitivity to my feelings.
Yeah.
That means
yeah.
a lot to me.
Why don't you go first?
I appreciate your general sensitivity, Jason.
He is, though. I love that. Did your parents raise you that way, Jason? Is that what
That's
it is?
Adorable.
I don't know. I don't think so. But my son is exactly the same way, so I don't. It's interesting. Dear. Like I'm trying to figure out. Like yeah, it's always that question. Like, is it genetic or has he just been conditioned already to be like that? I don't know.
Well, you better treat him right. Tell him the kind of friends to look for.
If I look at him wrong, it's like it's a big deal.
Why
a real quote from my son. Why are you frustrated right now, Daddy? I get that a lot.
You know what I love about that story? That is exactly the child that Jason was going to have. I've known Jason since we were 19 years old, and that's precisely the kind of kid that you deserve. That's your kid. That is your kid.
Oh bless.
All right, so I will go first in a sudden twist. So what I wanted to talk about was the terrible terrorist attacks that happened in Brussels. 31 people were killed, over 300 wounded on September 22nd when a bunch of terrorists blew stuff up, I think.
It's ISIS, right? Did they take credit? ISIS took credit?
I think it was in ISIS. I'm going to figure that out.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, ISIS supposedly takes credit.
I have all this stuff up on my screen, so before we're done, I'll find out. But so what piqued my interest is that, you know, there was this outpouring of support on Facebook and social media around the world. Monuments were
erected.
No.
Not quite. That'd be quickly. Draped, maybe.
That'd be
with
amazing. Yeah, all around the world, monuments, they were flashing up the Belgium flag on things. And it reminded me of when the attacks happened in Paris in November.
Sure.
2015, when much the same way, people on Facebook were superimposing the French flag over their profile picture, and again, you know, the Empire State Building was red, white, and blue, not for us, but for France, and it sort of highlights something for me. The Islamic State was ISIS behind Brussels. What this highlights for me is that there are terrorist attacks somewhere on Earth every single day. In fact, between the Paris attacks and the Brussels attacks, there have been 259 separate incidents of terrorism. And that gets no love in the press and from social media. Now, I don't want to make this a numbers game. I looked up all these numbers. I wrote a whole bunch of stuff down about how many people died, how many people were wounded. To me, that's not really what this is about. It's not about, oh, well, a lot of people were wounded in Brussels, I suppose just 14 people gunned down in the streets of Nigeria or something. It's not about the numbers. It's just about the media coverage and also what seems to be, for me, what seems to be that, dare I say, it seems that when tragedies occur, some lives are more worthy of sympathy when they're lost, right, than others. What do you guys think about that? How would you look at what happens on Facebook and Twitter and other social media when these events occur?
Well, I think there's no question what you're touching on. I mean, it's absolute fact that we in the United States and white people in other predominantly white countries, the outrage is and the fear, the mourning are incredibly disproportional. Depending on, you know, what the people look like who were affected. You know, you look at places like Iraq and Pakistan, where, you know, and Syria, where the number of people, I hear what you're saying about numbers, but I mean, there's no comparison to victims of terrorism in countries of brown people, in some cases black people. It's so much higher, and it happens all the time. And the amount of attention it gets and the reaction to it is minuscule compared to when attacks much smaller in white countries, in European countries, happen. So I think it's absolutely a fact. And so I mean, we and I'm saying we very broadly, the powerful white people in the world, completely carved up that
that's
region.
You?
Yeah, yeah, me and a couple of my friends, a couple of my white my white friends. When I'm not talking to my black friends like you two, I'm talking to my white friends about how we can create the Middle East. But and so now to this day, I mean, we see the, you know, we see the results of that. You could even talk about India and Pakistan and the British Empire. And now, you know, we sowed the seeds of this awful conflict. People of color are, you know, dying in enormous numbers, and it's still kind of a, you know, a playground for military powers like Russia and us, for white military powers. And then when you have something in Belgium, I think we all agree, absolutely awful, terrible. We should be mourning, but we should be mourning just as much when these awful things are happening to people of color, and we just don't.
Trisha?
Well, I'm not as well-versed in history as Jason is, so I look at it as a kind of internalized oppressor piece, which is that I think that we believe that people in brown countries, we've always sort of exported violence to them, right? So it's like you can imagine that wherever you have colonized folks, you export the violence there so that when you're at home, you can get to live wonderfully and feel okay. So I think that when violent things happen in the home base, which essentially for us, the home base are places where there are less folks of color, it's even more dramatic, right? It's even more traumatizing. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, the people who control the news cycle are folks in power. And so they are the ones that are sort of telling us that you should be grieving this very horrible thing. I remember actually reading a couple articles around the time of the Paris attacks, because something had preceded the Paris attacks, I think, quite briefly, which was, I think, attacks in Nigeria had happened, and people were
in Beirut the day
before. Something had happened in, and I remember someone had written a piece about unequal grief, and it sort of follows a theme that we talked about, I think, in our maybe two podcasts ago, where we talked about the idea that our oppressors don't believe that brown people feel the same pain, so that our deaths don't add up to much. And also, I just think about the images that I see of other of countries of color. Really, we sort of, especially in places like in the U.S., I see images of hunger, disillusionment, of chaos. That's the image that I've been sold about other countries. So why should we be remarking on it when that's supposedly their everyday existence?
Well, this is something that I hear all the time. Like, when I pose this to people, and I was, you know, I've been viciously trolling people on my Facebook.
You're so bad. I saw that.
Viciously trolling people. But the thing that I always hear is like, oh, well, you know, that kind of stuff happens in those kinds of countries all the time.
Oh, exactly.
So it's not really a surprise. And it was like, well, children die there too. You know, 10 days before the attacks in Brussels, there was an attack in Grand Bassam in Ivory Coast where six men just walked up to a beach resort and just opened fire. And there's pictures in the New York Times of, like, these children. Like, I mean, people were – non-military people were killed. You know, no one really blinked. And on that same day, 37 people died in Turkey when bombs went off. And again, we didn't really –
Is Turkey a vacation destination? Because I also like to think that we really react to bombings in tourist destinations.
Can I tell you the day that those bombings in Paris happened, I was like bummed, and I was talking to a friend. He says to me, "Well, because the bombings in Beirut happened the day before," and he says, well, you know, the reason why people care about Paris and not Beirut is because, like, Paris is, like, a popular, like, tourist destination. So, like, when you see the bombings there, you're like, oh, no, Paris. I love Paris. And I'm thinking, let me get this straight. You're only interested in the places you could possibly vacation. And so when your playgrounds are attacked, then you want to feel some certain way about it, even though people are dying in other places.
Well, of course.
Absolutely true. Yeah, no, we'll just get back to... We relate to things that we feel some, you know, investment in, and we do not feel invested in Beirut. I think commonly Americans see Beirut as just been a, although this is not exactly accurate, just been a mess and a war-torn place forever. But and so no one's going to vacation there anymore, although they did many years ago. But yeah,
was,
you talk about
it was hot like 10 years ago. Beirut was like the new place to be. Remember?
Well, there was a time when Beirut was called the Paris of the Middle East, and it's not anymore. And so, but yeah, that's absolutely true. I just want to take a moment to mention. I've been jumping around on my computer to find some information because even I'm ignorant about this, but I know it exists. Here's a headline from an article on the NewsHub.com. The war. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the war with a death toll the highest since the Holocaust that you've probably never heard of. There's been war in the Congo, and this is all so interesting because it's interesting how these things overlap. The Congo following war in the 19th century was given to the King of Belgium, so
yeah.
It's just interesting. But, I mean, in the Congo, there's been an awful war going on, like, forever. And not only... do we not hear about it in the United States? And it's just incredible to me the number of people been killed. I'm looking at a statistic now: 48 women per hour were getting raped.
Jesus Christ! And that is some assembly line. Oh my God!
It was not showing up on any of our news outlets, and this was going on. But what's even worse? It's not just that it was going on. It's that much of the impetus for the chaos and the killing was who gets to control. The mining operations of the mining of raw materials for our iPhones. Seriously, like, we're not only are we ignoring that millions of people are being killed and raped every day, we're funding. I'm not saying we're doing it on purpose, but we're funding much. I mean, it's over our money that a lot of this is happening. Now, Apple's taken some steps. I want to give credit. They've taken some steps to, you know, make sure or minimize the amount to which, like, their operations are contributing to this. But this is like an enormous conflict killing tons of black people all the time, just not getting into our news. The article I'm looking at now, by the way, written by a British reporter, because the American media has decided to ignore this conflict for years and years and years.
Well, I want to flash back to something that you said earlier, Tricia. And Tricia, try not to breathe into the mic so much because it's getting frightening. It's like,
I think she's falling asleep. I think she's dozing off. Like, Trisha's still not awake. She's like dozing off. The more we talk, she's like, I'm just gonna take a nap. Jason's I'll wake up when he's done.
I'm entirely awake. I'm entirely awake and watching you two fools. That's it.
Okay.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you. So, like I was saying, I wanted to flash back to something Tricia said about things being in your backyard and caring about them. So the San Bernardino attacks happened in December when some homegrown terrorists shot up a bunch of people in San Bernardino, California. Now, while that got a lot of coverage around, I feel like it wasn't the same... when it wasn't the same outpouring of sort of like grief and group sympathy that we get with these attacks overseas. And I'm struggling to understand why that is. Now, partly I think because at the end of the day, news outlets can't really comment too much on gun violence in America because then it might be a problem. And then if it's a problem, we might have to do something about it. So, but I wonder, is that it? Is that why... when these attacks happen in faraway, beautiful lands that are mostly white, do you think that's why it is versus, I mean, San Bernardino is in California. Like, the people who shot up the people in San Bernardino, like, their friends could drive to where each of us are and shoot us. Like, it's not like you don't have to get on a boat or a plane. Why is it that we treat these foreign things, like, so differently, do you think?
Go ahead, Jason.
No, you go.
No, Jason's talked too much.
Yeah, while you're awake, Tricia. I don't want to lose this opportunity.
Oh, oh man, it's like pile on Tristan today. No, I think you know what it is though. I do think that there's something to be said for Christopher's really, really insightful friend at that party. I mean, I think there's also
get him on the show next time.
No, I know, but I think there's a level. I do think there's a level of fantasy that, especially American media has about Europe. You know, I mean, there is a kind of just like they do about sort of like their heritage, like Italians think fondly about Italy, or I think that Americans have a real fantasy about European countries, and this notion that in some sense that they are, they're not better than us, but they live a kind of exoticized life,
yeah,
which is why you want to, you know,
a little more twee than ours. They're just,
yeah, like genteel.
They're the authentic white people. They're
yes,
the original white people.
Yes, yes, and there's like a gentility that we sort of project onto them that mm-hmm. I think is really. So I think that's why when bad things happen to them, it sort of shocks and rocks Americans to the core. And also, let's think about the reverse. Think about how other people treated 9/11.
What do you mean other people? You mean foreign people?
Foreign people, and even foreign brown people. Because they, in some sense, have an idea of America as well as a place where terrorist activities do not happen on our soil. We might fund it and we might do other things to make it happen in their region, but we sort of, but even America kind of gets held up as a kind of fantasy island, right? A fantasy place that we were sold. I remember seeing sort of outpourings of grief from people whose daily experience were of terror. So when they saw it happen to Americans, I mean, I don't know if those images were totally like pulled in from fantasy, but no, I saw people gathered around looking in dismay and horror at what was happening on our soil. So I do think that there is that kind of strange relationship that people have with the other, with the foreign. And I think for Americans, the other and the foreign are these, like, quote-unquote, exclusively white places where we have fantasies about them. Just like I think with brown people, they have a fantasy about America as the other, as a place that's supposedly more stable, more able to be this dreamland in some way that they dream of coming to. And so when tragedy starts striking us, it's like, what the hell?
Well, but... You know, when you were saying, like, as far as, like, you know, America's a place where this sort of terrorist activity doesn't happen, you know, on Wikipedia, when I was, like, researching this, Wikipedia lists all these homegrown white men shooters here in America as terrorist acts. So Dylan Roof, who shot up the church in South Carolina, they list him as terrorist. San Bernardino was on there. Those were Americans committing those crimes. I wonder how those stories play in the press, like when those kindergartners were shot up in Connecticut in December a couple of years ago. I wonder how that plays up, or if we don't export that news because of what I said before, you know, gun violence in America is a very touchy topic, and we can't actually highlight it too much because then we'd have to do something about it.
We definitely don't export that news, and we don't export it as homegrown terrorists. So
people would never think of that as terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, we think of it as kind of, I mean, if you think about the way that we report those things that happen, we sort of report them almost like weird accidents, like this weird compulsion
oops,
that, oops, yeah, it's like,
kindergarten.
Yes, whoops, this, well, usually the perpetrator is so carefully individualized that we actually make them a part of the story, but they're anti-heroes. That's how we report them in the news. Do you know what I mean? We report them in the news as anti-heroes, and so we sell it as kind of a really involved drama when bad things happen in America, especially if the act is perpetrated by typically a crazed white man. Then we know the usual tropes. You know, he was sensitive, he helped his neighbor, you know, but something just went wrong.
Killing spree.
I mean, you know, and then essentially he becomes this really kind of Oh, woe is he!
A misunderstood loner who made a bad decision one day, which led to this. Forget about the access to guns and mental health and et cetera. So,
yeah, and so it doesn't. It's not even grounded in something that's wrong with America, which I think helps us sell that story and helps America continue to sort of be seen in sort of a different light than anywhere else. Because if you think about it, you're right. A lot of terrorist activities have happened on our soil. But because it's been individualized, it doesn't feel like a kind of group that's assaulting America.
So, Jason, I'm going to give you the last word. How do, in this, when it comes to this particular issue, and I hesitate to call it like journalism. What happens on social media is not journalism, but it does create a world. It does create a conversation and maintain a conversation. How do we expose or disconnect white supremacy here? Because that's what's going on, right?
So that Jason, is what's going on. I feel like I usually have pretty strong opinions, however unrealistic, about solutions.
Oh, this unrealistic one's a tough one. Is definitely your tagline.
Yeah, that's fine. That's I want that to be on my tombstone.
He's the Bernie. He's the Bernie of our podcast.
I don't know the answer because it's interesting the way you framed the question when you said, I don't know if I'd call it journalism because of social media, but in this day we know that there's constant interplay between journalism and social media. I mean, how many clicks something gets or how many times it's forwarded, I mean, that drives what kind of stories we get from news outlets. So, I mean, you know, it's like we've talked before about, you know, what do we do about, you know, not perpetuating, you know, like professional sports that are damaging to, you know, people of color disproportionately. Well, we need to stop investing time and money in them. That's a much more complicated thing to do in the way that news is delivered today because, you know, we engage with content when it's free and it's online. Other than a wave of journalists starting new outlets where they do pay attention and report on other things and then market them in such a way that they get out. I mean, I'm thinking what Tricia just said, and I have not seen this yet either. I heard that two Americans were killed. That's as much as I heard about what the story you're telling. But, you know, that's being packaged in a way like I can see that. There's an attractive girl, and she's one of the victims, and that's how many people will engage with the story. Like, that makes sense to me. I feel like we need some creative activist journalists to figure out how to package stories of people of color who are victims and being able to tell their stories. Beyond that, I guess for people like the three of us, none of whom are, you know, professional. I don't know, Tricia, maybe we call you professional journalists, but I'm certainly not. But you know, I feel like we should be going on our first Facebook pages and putting in a watermark of the colors of the Iraqi flag or you know, the
Nigerian
flag.
Yeah, that would go over.
People be like, what? There's something wrong with your page. Have you been hacked into? What's that image? I've never seen that before. But
there'd
other
be a
than
knock
something
on
like
your
that,
door,
I don't
and the
know.
NSA would be like, come with us, please.
Well, I mean, I will say as a kind of, I don't know if this is a curative. I don't know if that's a word, corrective. But, you know, the fact that we're even engaging in this dialogue, in this conversation about the coverage, I have seen a lot of that conversation on Twitter. And one of the reasons why that can happen is that on Twitter, we are interacting with countries where people are also telling us their stories of grief. So I did see people talking about the Ivory Coast, and I did see people talking about Beirut because they were there. You know, and so I think as much as you can sort of move away from corporate media, which I think is what we're getting in like the age of social media, and you do have access to people telling their own stories about what's happening to them, I think the better that is. I mean, even here in the U.S., you know what I mean? As much as you sort of move away from sort of the corporatized version of reality that we get about America for American consumption, the better. So I think there is some sort of that is happening. I mean, there is dialogue around this very notion. Like, why are we putting up the flag of France and not the flag of this country? I did see those kinds of storylines pop up here and there. Not overwhelmingly, but I saw it.
Sure, but they never seem to gain any traction. Like, instead of people actually doing the thing or actually doing what Jason's suggesting, which is to, like, humanize these people when they are attacked, we have a discussion on why they're not humanized, which,
well,
I feel like what you're saying.
It's a starting place.
Yeah, but you know how I feel about starting places? Like, we can acknowledge the problem, but then if we don't move forward, you're part of the problem.
Well, just to say, I'm the queen of selfishness, as you already know, and I know.
Oh, there's another good epithet. I like that.
I know.
I'm unrealistic. You're the queen of selfishness. All right.
It is.
Well,
I'm
just, like, handsome and affable, I guess.
Exactly. That's it. I never. Can I tell you? I never changed my Facebook profile. Never did. I never do. I don't know why, but it never occurs to me. When the equal signs were going up, no. When the Je suis Paris was going, nope. I mean, I don't know. I'm just like, it takes a lot for me to say I'm going to sort of submerge my identity in something, and then it just never occurs to me to do that.
I wouldn't do it just because what you said, sort of like hitch your wagon to a single idea and roll with that. Like,
yeah, I can't do it.
I understand what happened in all of these countries, from France to Nigeria and back again, is really terrible. But for me to, like, sort of co-sign on one when these things are happening every day. So, like, attacks go down in Belgium, and then since Belgium, like, what was that, last week? There have been 7 terrorist attacks around the world. So am I changing my flag every day? So if I leave it up as Belgium, then what I'm saying, the stuff that happened in Israel and Afghanistan, in some ways, then I become part of the problem.
I don't know. I mean,
We're screwed.
It's a good try.
You know what?
Thanks for introducing this very depressing topic, Christopher.
And wrapping this up yet again.
Good morning, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Sure. Blame white people. I'm going to assume. Let's close it out like that. Okay. Jason, let's hear your topic next. What is it?
Okay. So, stay with me now. I'm going to draw from a couple of sources real quick.
Oh, dear.
So, first of all, article in the New York Times, November 2015. The headline is "Death Rates Rising for Middle-Aged White Americans." Study finds. And the sentence I'd just like to point us to is, "The researchers concluded that rising annual death rates among this group are being driven not by the big killers like heart disease and diabetes, but by an epidemic of suicides and afflictions stemming from substance abuse, alcoholic liver disease, and overdoses of heroin and prescription opioids." So that's one fact there. And then, you know, a while back, I think when this study came out, there was on the Slate Political Gabfest, there was a conversation about this, and David Plotz, the host, who I guess is just as annoying as Chris is as host of this, but...
let's take a break and have a group session, okay?
So Plotz posited that while this could not be proven, I remember him saying something like, is this because, like, middle-aged, you know, white people, you know, grew up in an age when white people were still kind of clearly dominant, and both in numbers and in power, and now as,
is that
you know,
over?
White people are headed... Well, I think what we do... Is the age over? Maybe not, but you know, there are clear projections that whites are going to be in the minority very soon. And though your question, this was what gets to what I wanted to talk about, is the question is the fact that Obama is president, along with the amount of attention we're getting of how many Hispanics are in the country, and you know, Muslims coming to the country, Syrian refugees, people from the Middle East. You know, I'm wondering whether that is possibly driving, you know, a lot of these things, the rise of Trump. You know, this was said about the Tea Party. The last, like, little quote I'm going to share with you, and then I want to hear what you two think about this. I'm going back to a book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well by Derek Bell, African-American Harvard Law professor, which is a phenomenal book, by the way. It's informed much of my thinking, which may make you not want to read it. But one of the things that, he says that the system in America is, and then here I quote, "reliant on an identifiable group on whose heads less well-off whites can discharge their hate and frustration for societal disabilities about which they are unwilling to confront their leaders. So to put that another way is the way that poor and working class whites from the beginning of the country have been kept in line is by powerful whites being able to say to them, hey, yeah, you don't have it so great, but at least you don't have as bad as those black people. And now that opportunity, those faces at the bottom of the well being black people, now that you have one of those faces as the president of the United States, clearly not at the bottom of the well, and increasingly faces of color in positions of power, in gaining in numbers, you know, is that driving white despair, white people following someone like Trump, white people committing suicide, white people, you know, getting addicted to heroin? I leave it to you two.
The answer, Jason, is yes.
No, I mean, well, we got feedback. We should be less long-winded, so I guess we just achieved that.
I think moving on. No, what you're saying is absolutely true. Although I would say, I think absolutely that's true. This is why we see the rise of Nazism/Trump in this country and white nationalism and the rest of that. It's in reaction to Barack Obama, but also in reaction to just where the world is moving. You know, the internet has connected us in such a way. Trisha mentioned earlier about Twitter, how we get news from people it's happening to as it happens. And that has really transformed, it's given people more access to different points of view, but also put people of color and foreign people not at the center of the conversation, but at least they're in the conversation now. And I think that does frustrate people who were told, when you think about the middle of the country, you know, working white poor, it's as you say, Jason, like they're working, they're poor, their families don't have much, but even in places where there are no black people, they can feel superior to black people. Now, when you have black people being president and you have black people organizing boycotts of Oscars and then seizing the conversation around the Oscars, which is a fun playground for white people, it does impact. And I think I wouldn't connect it to the suicide rates and drugs. I think that's something completely different. I'd love to rip that topic to shreds with you guys another time. I don't know if that's directly connected, but I think the answer is absolutely yes. Obama's presidency and just what we've seen over the past, like, I say post 9/11, so it's like the past 10 years where we as people are striving for equity in media, in journalism, in all sorts of other aspects of life. That is really pissing off a sect of people.
Well, I mean, you know, I've mentioned this before, and I think he did a really good job of kind of grounding me in this thinking a little bit more. So, and by he, I mean Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? Ta-Nehisi Coates, I read between the words.
I love how you just say he. Capital H, the second coming.
Well, I'm about to say it, I know. But I was about to say it. I'm about to talk about the fact that he grounded it in, yeah, I know, I was going to say it, because everybody's like, Ta-Nehisi Coates, why is he getting all this praise? But you know what?
The busiest black man in America.
In America. But you know what? He wrote a compelling book, and you know the most important thing about it? He didn't make it 300 pages. So you know, he distilled some very simple ideas out in less than, you know.
His articles, but what's interesting is the articles in the Atlantic are 300 pages. Like, that's what's so funny about that.
You know what I can just picture? I can picture Trisha's quote on the back of his book. Like, everyone's like, great book, read it. And Trisha's like, it was short. I enjoyed that.
I love it. I can finish it one day.
Get to the point. But you know what? I think the one of the most salient things that I really took away from this book was this notion of whiteness. And I think this gets
Wait,
at
I'm
this.
Sorry to interrupt you, but which book are you talking about that he wrote? The one the
I
letter
said
to
it,
his...
Between the World and Me. Yeah.
You didn't say that, but
you didn't
okay.
Say that,
right? I did.
Okay.
I did.
No,
and
no,
you
said that
Between the World and Me.
Listeners, let us know if you just said it or
I
not.
I did. You did. You know what? You guys were reacting
replay.
To
replay. Chris,
no.
Rewind it. Let's watch.
You could, because I remember it coming out of my mouth. So you guys are going to be like, oh my God, no, she did say it, but we were making fun of the big he. No. No, so Between the World and Me, I did. I said Between the World and Me. No, but I think one of, you know, obviously there's some really sad elements in Between the World and Me, but I do think one of the interesting elements in it is this notion of whiteness. And what does whiteness mean? Now, I think it's always been really sad to me that whiteness has always been in contrast to the suffering that the other was meant to assume for whiteness. So in some ways, it really supports Jason's notion of how white people had defined their whiteness, that they had defined their whiteness in contrast to the other being subjugated.
I see.
Do you see what I mean?
So their identity is in opposition to another identity. It doesn't.
Yes.
It's not built on a positive connotation. It's just because we're not black.
Yes.
Or we're not Asian, or we're not anything.
Or we're white because we're white, and then we make you suffer for not being white.
I see.
And so in some sense, in some weird and really horrific way, they identified with being the oppressor and enjoyed it.
Go ahead, sir.
No, and so when you're pointing these things out, so when you then tell me that the things that are sort of making white people afraid is the very notion that their oppressor status might be changing. Those are the things that you're pointing to. Their subjugation status might be changing. Their ability to subjugate more people is changing. And that is, in some sense, depressing. I mean, let's think about that. That's a horrific, that was a horrific identity to begin with.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, that is an identity that was, I believe, very deliberately constructed in the late 15th century as Europeans. I was going to say white, but I think at the moment, white wasn't an important concept. It became important when they said we could amass an enormous amount of wealth or increase our wealth. And I'm talking about Spanish folks, English folks, you know, we know the six countries of Europe. And they said, if we enslave, at first it was, you know, the people indigenous to this new land that we found, the Americas. And then when that didn't go so well, if we import Africans, you know, there was this opportunity they saw to become much more wealthy. And so there was this construction of like, well, these people aren't really people.
Yep.
So it's fine for us to treat them like beasts of burden and have them till the land and us get the wealth. And it's just, to me, what we are reckoning with right now is it's 500 years of a construct which affects the whole world now. I don't know, it's just really extraordinary to me how that narrative has been in place so long, and maybe it's unraveling now. I mean, I'm curious to hear from you, Chris. I know you don't want to go off on I'm curious how quickly you were like, well, I don't think that has anything to do with the suicide or the drug addiction. Like, why not?
I think that has its roots. It has its roots elsewhere. I think it's tangential.
Where is that root?
Well, I think, one, drugs in white communities have always been a problem. It's been a certain type of drug that it's been certain types of drugs that have been problems in white communities that have been problems in black communities. It's sort of like there's this old joke where, like, you know, if you hear about someone trying to score cocaine, you don't really think about it as a black person because black people aren't busy doing cocaine. You know what I mean? But I think over time, because I remember start hearing about like this meth epidemic in the American heartland. Mm-hmm. And there was all this talk about how, like, in these farm communities, people were like were cooking meth in like grain silos and stuff. And now it's infiltrated white suburbia and the edges of white urban communities. I don't know if the way you made it sound, Jason, was that like people were committing suicide because they were losing their oppressor status, or they were turning to drugs because they were losing their oppressor status. I don't know if I want to co-sign on to that. I feel like it has its roots in several different things.
Well, see, I always thought this, and this is one of Trisha's pet theories, is I've often thought that it was.
That should be a morning show. Hi, welcome to Trisha's pet
theories. But it's not so much that they were losing their oppressor status that I thought that drugs had an impact on white communities. But I've always thought it was really interesting that white suburbans were essentially dulling their senses. They created this fantasy space where they could go and escape minorities, right? That's what suburbs were. White enclaves. And yet they would go there and be bored out of their skulls and No, right?
And start doing meth.
No, and start doing meth. One to the other. Yes, not just doing meth, but alcoholism. You know, I mean, and the isolation that they created for, I mean, especially men created for their wives. I mean, that's what happened with the feminist movement. That's what Betty Friedan was talking about, right? Yeah, I mean, just think about that world. Think about the isolation of the wives trapped in homes.
Unable to work.
And then their husbands are going out to work, coming home, unable to communicate with their wives because, of course, they thought their wives were idiots. I mean,
you know what
it's
this
just...
always reminds me of whenever I think about this? The honeymooners.
Yeah!
Alice never left the house. And when her husband came home, he was always threatening her with physical violence.
Yes. That's so true. To the moon, Alice. I don't want to hear it. I worked hard all day.
And it was endearing. But I just want to say that I do think that America has always kind of given people fantasies that were self-destructive. You know, the suburban fantasy became self-destructive. It became a prison. And I do think that, I mean, that's one of the things that people talked about with the rise in drug use, right? And I think, Chris, when you said that they've always had problems with drugs, yes, it's been prescription medication. Why? Because I'm bored out of my mind as a housewife, because you tell me that that's my value as a woman. And I'm dulling my senses there. So they've
alcoholism.
Yes, and alcoholism. But see, I think they've always suffered for their oppressive whiteness status. It's just they didn't see it as that.
Right. Well, that's a great point. Something I wanted to say, and that I think it builds on what you're just saying. You know, you both use the terms like white people are losing their oppressor status or their – well, so I mean, it, obviously all of this is –
I just want to strike that. I'm not saying white people are losing their oppressor status.
No, because they still got it.
Yeah, they're going to have it for a long time. Because, like, I'm sorry to steal your comment, Jason. Please don't lose your train of thought. But just to flash back something you said, Jason, as far as, you know, demographics show that white people are going to be the minority soon. I don't know what that means, because white supremacy is iron tight. Like, they're not losing their oppressor status anytime soon.
No, they're losing their number. They're losing their number. That's it. It doesn't mean they're losing their power. Well, they lose their number. That's been scary for people.
I think it's important, though. So my guess, and all of this is speculation, but my guess is, like, we're talking about poor and working class white people. I don't know that that group, no, I would go so far to say, I don't think that that group ever saw themselves as oppressors. I think they saw themselves as, and see themselves as, victims or potential victims. I think
the defining them as oppressors, and the fact that they are looking down at the face of the bottom of the well, like, isn't that sort of
they saw themselves as better. They saw themselves as better,
but that's different from oppressor. That's different.
Because they didn't fully buy into you're right, Jason. They didn't fully buy into their oppressor status because they thought that they had less than the other whites, but at least they still had
Right, and I think the added part is, and if we don't keep those black people at the bottom of the well, we are at risk of being overrun by, you know, fill in your stereotypical awful behavior.
They must be brought to heel.
Stop.
Right. But I think in the United States this is something I think about. Everyone in the United States, including wealthy, powerful whites, see themselves as a victim, right?
Yes, they do.
Everybody's a victim. The wealthiest owners of businesses are victims of overtaxation and overregulation. Yeah. And so everyone's a victim. The question is I think the only distinction is, who do you perceive as victimizing you? And I think what's happening, and this is potentially could be a good thing, and I think back to Bell's comment about unwilling to confront, you know, powerful whites, like working and poor whites, unwilling to confront the powerful whites. That is actually, I mean, if you look at Trump and Sanders now, arguably they are starting to confront, you know, Trump is confronting, and even Cruz is confronting powerful whites. Now, unfortunately, they're still doing it in the context of, you're going to let those brown people, you know, and black people run us. But there is a confrontation. I mean, that's why I go back to things we've talked about before, which is like, if someone could, you know, could take it and like actually remove it from, like, this is not about black and brown threats. This is solely about, you know, the exploitation by powerful whites. If someone could make that message resonate. But I just think that that's important.
Well, I think
that
Sanders
everybody sees themselves as a victim in this country. Everyone's a victim. We're all victims.
Well, I think Sanders is trying to. But
yeah,
I think he does it poorly. Because
yes,
it's not
right.
accidental that all of the people who have mostly been impacted by powerful whites are brown and black people. And he hasn't been willing to make that connection. And because he hasn't been willing to make that connection, his group of fans or people who support him are overwhelmingly white. You know, he's building a coalition of disaffected white people, which we already know is not enough to win an election.
Right.
It
reminds
not,
me,
yeah.
I mean, Sanders, in some ways, you know, it's interesting he's a socialist Democrat. It reminds me of what I would call a mistake, and I'll shut up in a minute because this could take us a whole different direction. But to me, this was a big mistake of communism and the Soviet experiment, which is, well, you know, it's capitalism is the problem, and race and ethnic difference are not really significant. They're just symptomatic
yeah.
of capitalism. And so you saw the Soviet Union, you know, take over all of these countries of different ethnicities, but and with a message of empowerment, but then basically try to erase their ethnic identities. I mean, I spent a little bit of time in Mongolia, and it was just fascinating how, you know, in some ways Soviet Union helped, like, education was better and healthcare was better. And yet, because they were like, you can't use your alphabet, and you can't use these names, and we're outlawing the history of Genghis Khan, like, to perpetuate their message, they were like, we need to erase difference.
Yep.
But difference is important to people, and cultures are important, and ethnicities are important. And Sanders, I think you're right, Tricia, is also trying to ignore that. Like, none of that is significant. What's significant is that capitalism is killing us. And
yep.
while there may be some truth to that, people of color in particular are not rallied by, like, you know, your racial and ethnic difference don't matter. Like, this is about capitalism. Like, that doesn't resonate with people.
Yeah, and your dream doesn't.
Not in this
what
country.
Is, yeah, and also, yeah, and then what is the dream?
Not race anymore.
Yeah, what is your dream? Because my suspicion, to be honest, is my suspicion of a lot of Bernie folks is that they're just upset that they don't perceive themselves as the head of the pecking order anymore. And I think that's why, I would say that's why some people of color are suspect of that part of that campaign, is that do you really want to tear everything up, or are you just as mad as the Trumpers and mad about your loss of place? So, you know.
That's a complicated question. I'm sure it's different for different sectors.
It's complicated. But those are supposedly the nice whites. So. Listen, that's what Trump.
No,
you know, it's the nice whites that Chris Rock said. Remember when Chris Rock made that joke about them always been? They're always white people. It's just that we are being reared. We are in a generation filled with nicer whites, right?
Nicer whites.
I mean, that's horrible. I'm sorry. This podcast is going to come across as so anti, but no,
we are just. Banging on white people, but you know, I.
But we're not banging on white people. We're banging on white supremacy. Now, if you
and I think I want to just. I know we ended up here and we're all laughing, but like on that point, seriously, I think this is what we need to be doing. I think people need to expose white supremacy all the time
yes.
and just really show it to people. Doesn't mean white people are bad people, but when white people are out there supporting candidates who don't really want to change anything for everyone, but just them,
yep.
like that, they don't even know it. Like, no, this will be helpful for everyone because it will help me. Like,
right.
It's breaking out of that.
The Dick Cheney theory of governance. The richer I get, the better for everyone. So
or like people who come at me from the Sanders camp. Well, you're just ridiculous for not realizing that Bernie Sanders is the most thoughtful candidate that's going to impact your community, because we're talking about poverty and poverty is all you care about. No, boo. It isn't.
No, but... sorry. I'm a complex individual with many different needs, wants, desires.
I'm actually black and not poor. Did you know
exactly.
That? There are a couple of us.
And you're black and not poor, and you're not thinking about prison? I mean, I think about prison as a criminal justice issue, but I don't personally know anyone in prison. So,
I'm a black man. I think about bullets in my back. Should. I don't have to think about prison. I think about bullets in my back.
But no, it's really your poverty that's really your problem, Christopher.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, my poverty.
I remember once I told someone, you know, I spent the first 10 years of my life in a black suburb, and they were like, there are no black suburbs.
There you go. I'd probably cackle just like that. Yeah.
Black suburb? That's an oxymoron. We keep all the black people in ghettos. What are you talking about?
Black professionals? What are black professionals?
First window. I can't. All right.
What are black professionals?
Let's move on. Last week, Trish's topic was arguably the best topic, as you know, as evidenced by Trish's own statements.
Yeah.
I wonder if her topic
scientifically proven by Trisha
pass muster.
So, Trisha, I don't know if it is. So okay,
first of all, let listeners know right away. Will we be beating up white people again?
No, we might be beating up men though.
All right, good. So that's great.
White men. Sorry, Jason, you lose all three topics.
Yeah. I'm at the nexus of all of the punching.
You might be included too, Christopher. So, anyway, so, you know, my other pastime and my other loves, besides being friends of these two people, is tennis. It's what I do. And so, so something really amazingly horrific happened in tennis last week. So last week, there was a tennis tournament in Indian Wells, California, which is the closest thing to Indian Wells is Palm Springs, just for location purposes for y'all. So the
neither of which place I've ever been anywhere near, but go ahead.
It's okay. Palm Springs used to be the playground of wealthy retired Hollywood stars. So that gives you a real sense of it. It's like an upscale Florida. You know, dry desert.
I want to go to there.
I'm sure you do.
Florida, I'm in.
Yeah, right? Because that's always been the problem with Florida. Slightly downscale.
I feel like, Trisha, you should be a writer for John Oliver, because you know how he loves to start segments with, like, Sanders, you know, Sanders supporters, the nice whites, Palm Springs, upscale Florida. Like, I feel like you should apply for that job. You'd be perfect.
I'm happy.
Just, you need to write, like, another Devil's Dictionary where it's just all these things, like, messed up.
So anyway, so in this tournament, they had the CEO of the tournament, who's the tournament director, essentially was having a breakfast riff with the media. So, you know, sitting around, feeling himself, and talking about all the improvements to the tournament. And then in the midst of it, his name is Raymond Moore, he then goes on this sort of tandem about women's tennis. Tangent, that's what it is, thanks. Women's tennis. They ask him, say, tell me about the state of women's tennis. And he then proceeds to say he really thinks that all of people in women's tennis should get down on their knees every single night. Every single night. And thank the stars for the existence of Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal, because they have been the one to keep tennis going.
Wow.
No.
That seems objectively wrong. Like,
okay. And then,
like, did the interviewers gasp?
No, this is interesting, right? No one gasped. And so then he proceeded to say, but, you know, tennis, you know, women's tennis is sort of...
more?
Yes, but, you know, and then he proceeded to go on and talk about the fact that the tour is going to be in a really good place in the future, because there are a couple of attractive players coming out. And he actually, the funny thing is, he listed attractive players that are actually, like, in, like, not even highly ranked per se, but they're very well known as attractive in the sense that you would think they are blonde women, who would be able to take over the sport, the mantle of the sport, once Serena Williams retires. And somebody asked him, well, do you mean attractive by their game or attractive...
They're trying so hard.
The way they swing that racket is so attractive.
They're trying to throw a blanket over this raging firestorm. Like, trying to, like, hey, let us help you. You mean, like,
right, right.
So,
water, bucket brigade, please.
I know. But by the way, when he started the women thing, he started the women's comment by saying he would like to return as a lady player. He wanted to return. If he could come back to life, he wanted to come back to life as a lady player. Because, and then he proceeded into the get down on your knees comment. So, of course, you know, because you all don't watch tennis, this was like a raging mess. He said this comment on Sunday, and he had been allowed to resign on Monday.
Wow.
Wow.
But the reason why I'm raising this question is, of course, and I wrote a piece about it on SonyTennisTravels.com, by the way. I talked about this, but my piece
What's
was...
What's that website, Trisha?
SonyTennisTravels.com.
Can you spell that out?
Yeah. I wrote a piece where basically I thought the major issue, in besides all the sort of salacious elements in what he said, was really the fact that for a very, very, very long time, we have been using men's tennis as the centerpiece of tennis. And I think we can extrapolate that for any other sport as well. And so sure. One of the things that's really intriguing is that it's really only in tennis where men and women actually make approximately the same amount of money at the Grand Slams. At the Grand Slams, the four major signature. So if you go on and look at a list of the top earning female athletes, overwhelmingly the athletes on that list will be tennis players. Because every other arena, there's no sort of push for equity in that way. Equal pay in that way. So think about the WNBA and how little they probably make in compared to the major NBA stars and why that is and what happens there. So I was just trying to figure out. So my question to you was, you know, is there any way that you can sort of fix the market?
What does that mean?
Should we have affirmative action for women's sports?
Meaning, what would that look like?
What dollars? Yeah, like you're talking about taking dollars from men's sports revenue and investing it in female sports.
Yeah, and investing some, and it's a strategy. I'm asking you, what is the strategy? Because essentially, what happened was it was never okay for women to participate in sports. It's a recent thing, so we're behind the eight ball. Theoretically, right? Which is the argument that have been used for affirmative action programming in other places, right? We're behind the eight ball. And so in order for women to catch up, you cannot just use pure math.
Well, my response to that is this. I think there's an argument to be made there. I would say, though, where that investment would be best made, in my opinion, is not in propping up the WNBA players per se, but in investing in talent way down the line. I mean, if you look at men's sports, part of why, take like football, we as a country invest a lot of money in cultivating male football talent at a very young age. And, you know, that's why our NFL players get bigger and bigger and bigger and faster and faster and faster. And better and better and better in terms of what they can accomplish on the field. They also get less and less healthy, but that, in the long term. But that's a separate conversation. So, you know, I think I've never thought about this before, Trisha. But I think there's an argument to be made, and I just think if we're going to do that, if we're going to say we're going to take some of the revenue from male sports, and as a corrective action, as an affirmative action, we're going to try to, you know, invest in things that will promote equality or equity. Then what that will mean is investing in sports for girls at a young age and then programs at the junior high school, college level that provide the same amount of talent cultivation as we currently invest in boys and men, because we invest a ton.
I think that's what Title IX tried to do, but I know there's a lot of pushback. There's a lot of pushback because in Title IX, people see it as you're taking away from the boys to support the girls because you're claiming to want the same sort of support to go to women's sport as going to men's sport when the history and the structure doesn't exist for women's sports.
And right. Then it becomes circular. Again, yeah. Everyone's a victim. Yeah. A victim. Oh, my God. Men and boys in this society, we're such yeah. victims of you crazy women taking all of our money.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So I mean, this week it's reared its head in tennis, and so they're really it's just been extrapolated. And I've seen a lot of people say, you know, women don't do this as much, or do that as much. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, how do you create structures in society to support something that doesn't have a history? Yeah. I mean, this is the question. I mean, you could say the same thing about, you know, higher education. Why are there not enough people of color in higher education? How do you create affirmative programs for that? And people push back at that because they're tired. They don't want, you know, there's a point in time when affirmative action works and then they want to stop. 50 years. We're giving you 50 years. If you don't catch up in 50 years.
Chris looks like he's not buying it.
He's having a block because it's sports. He can't extrapolate it to something else.
I can't. It's entertainment because I think it's.
No, because can I tell you an argument that would be used in entertainment that you would immediately understand? Mm-hmm. It's the same reason why CEO says that they won't put together a black movie because it doesn't have the ability to make money. That's the same rationale. That's why people rationalize not putting black people in movies.
But even in that, they're wrong. Like, that's the thing. Like,
you don't know.
That has to do more with racism than what numbers have actually borne out over the past 5 or 6 years.
But numbers have borne out that women can sell, but you have to do the work to do it. It's the same thing I'm saying. Like, yes, there have been occasions where black movies make money. When you make it happen, though, but you have to test that all the time, and they're willing not to test it. And it's the same thing that's happening, in some ways, with women's sports. They're not willing to test it. What if we invested and see, but they don't want to test it?
You and Jason have already been circling around this, but the idea is that you have to do this from the ground up. You'd have to really put these things alongside each other and then build up the culture around women's sports. I think that's the answer. I think the more intriguing question, if I could, is what are the barriers to doing that? How do we get started? Like, again, like I said in the first segment, like, I think we can circle around what needs to be done like a million times. It doesn't, you don't get points for that.
But can I tell you what the barriers are? Think about the barriers. Think about the barriers that we talked about in the first segment, which is the inability for us to perceive the other as valuable. Extrapolate that to women and the inability for us to see women in a sports universe, because all the things that we embrace about athletes are really challenging things to embrace about the feminine.
I feel like we do a really good job of this around the Olympics.
Only then, for some weird reason, because it's amateur athletics, and I don't know why.
Let's talk about that for a second, because like, I think that's like, you think about all the excitement around like women's gymnastics. Now, men's gymnastics gets excitement too because those guys are so hot. It's like a problem. Like I have to see someone like because those guys are so hot. But like
for you, but yeah.
For me, yeah. But
your man crush. No,
that's a straight up crush. But I think around the Olympics, we get as excited about men and men's stories as we do about women and women's stories. Is there less of like a dollar incentive there?
Yes,
like, why
there's
is it
less
that
of a profit motive around the Olympics. Think about it. There's less of a profit motive around it because we're not talking about an industry now. We're talking about the Olympics.
So can we borrow what we do with women in the Olympics and apply it to the WNBA and to women's tennis? Like, I'm just riffing here. Is that possible?
I don't know, because you know what? I think during the Olympics, we're willing to support and really prop up these sort of sports notion for country. And so when you are doing it for country, there's not as much interest in sort of the dollars and cents and feeling like something is costing us things, because we're willing to subvert all of that for sort of nationalistic purposes and advertising dollars that come from actually propping up women's sports then, because then everybody's eyes are trained on it. But for some weird reason, that disappears.
No, I think it makes sense in this sense. Again, getting back to you know, we do what we see as in our self-interest. So in the Olympics, we want as many gold medals as possible. And as long as there are a ton of women's
as long as the women are useful
in the Olympics.
No, I think that that's true, though. Like, right now, so the I think what you said, Chris, is really an important point about, like, okay, we know what needs to be done, but, like, what the question becomes a question of will, and what would create the will to do it? And that what would create the will, for instance, to make the WNBA as invested in and lucrative as the NBA is if it looks like it's got to look additive and not subtractive. So, I mean, what you were saying, Tricia, about, well, if it's just taking money away from the men's, like, that's going to be very difficult to do because the people with the most power are going to do what they need to do to maintain their power. But if there's a way, and I don't know the answer, but if there's a way to articulate the need to invest in women's sports that ultimately adds to the revenue, and I don't know what that is. Maybe it's like, well, if we had a stronger WNBA, then more people would go to basketball games all over, like, or something like that. Like, that's when I think in any movement, if you want allies, you've got to be able to articulate how it's a value add to them.
What I'm saying is, listen, I'm not saying that women's sports doesn't make money. The NBA and the WNBA is really stark because there actually isn't that much investment. But in tennis, it's actually quite stark. Women do make money on the tour. Mm-hmm. It's a quite profitable tour. In comparison to the men, maybe not as much recently, but that's really just driven by the fact that they're stars of the tour. So just like the women should have potentially gone down on their knees and thanked Rafa and Roger, the men should have as well. Do you know what I mean? But, so, you know.
Yeah, but I'd love to never hear that reference again.
I know, it's a hot party.
How do I get an invite?
Yeah. Everyone's on their knees. But what I...
Oh, my God.
You know?
Oh,
my God. So, I do get your point, Chris. What I was trying to suggest, though, is that there had been a time when women made even more than men. And so there is proof that that can happen if all the right pieces work together, as Jason suggested.
So what were those pieces? Because this is what I was trying to get to with my Olympic thing. What were those pieces that are working, and how do we bring them back?
Do you know what? The pieces that were working was there were overwhelmingly strong American stars. They had a compelling story. It was the Williams sisters. The Williams sisters are the reason why we watched tennis in the evening. Because people wanted to make sure that it was box office. It was box office. The Williams sisters changed tennis's structure. It was box office. So that hasn't happened for the sports, and it doesn't happen on the men's side either. But for some weird reason, the men are allowed to sort of quote unquote fail for longer, without all these questions coming into play about it. Because there are no major male American
industry
star. Right?
I was just going to say that crosses out of entertainment.
Yes, because so what I'm saying is it's cyclical. This is this issue around women sort of not generating, it's really cyclical because at the time the women's game was stronger than the men's game and in some sense propped the men's game up. And now that the men's game theoretically is stronger because they have these two icons, everyone wants to forget that time historically when something was working for the women. It now seems like some sort of outlier because there's a normalizing function of thinking of men as being. That's what I didn't articulate that strongly. And so that's when I was thinking to myself, well, it seems to me that sometimes we're always quick to sort of abandon the other if it doesn't make money right away because it is the other.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the thing is, I mean, this is like what ultimately should drive us to pursue equity in all things across gender and race is, I think, what you're touching on, Tricia, which is that, like, in everything, we are incredibly nearsighted, right?
Yeah.
Like, even, I would say, like, just to go back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, to me, the message to poor and working class white people and middle-aged whites is, like, it is in your interest, as the population of people of color grows, for people of color to get better education and better pay. Because guess who is going to be, you know, supporting your Social Security? And guess who, like, it really is in the long-term interests, you know, whatever industry we talk about, it's in the long-term interests of the powerful minority to the larger population does better, because the powerful minority will ultimately in the long term lose if other people are not doing well. But we're so nearsighted, everyone's afraid of losing something tomorrow that they're not willing to give up something tomorrow to get a better return later.
I think you're right, because that's one of the things I hadn't really thought about very much, particularly around this tennis story and sports story, is that it's in your best interest to support sport, your sport being played by either gender.
Yes.
If you want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So also understanding that your sport doesn't have a gender. Like if you're a tennis fan, if you're a tennis fan, I don't want to get into who's a true tennis fan, who's not, but if you're a tennis fan, you're a fan of the game, and part of that would be looking at the way men play, looking at the way women play. I don't know if that translates to all sports. I feel comfortable saying that with tennis, but I feel like other sports, like people, I would get pushback on that, because I do think American football or soccer,
yeah.
I feel like those sports, people would be like, well, no, I'm a soccer fan, which means that I watch men's soccer.
But that does happen.
I think that's the marketing push that we're talking about. It's not about taking money away from men's sports and the women's sports. It's the idea of bringing women into the sport and being like, this is the sport. The sport of tennis encompasses, there's no two halves. It encompasses all these people. It's a joint effort
to support the thing you love. Right. And so that's what I mean in terms of any situation is like if you love the thing, if you love soccer, why aren't you supporting women's soccer?
Yeah.
I think that would be the thing.
Like, I'm a soccer fan, which means I like to watch people kick a ball down a soccer field for like 8 hours, and then all that matters is the goalkeeper at the end, and that was what wins the game, and the game's stupid, but whatever, I support that.
I like basketball, and I like to see people dunk a basket or put a basketball in a net. Why do I want to... I mean, and I can make distinctions between the men's and the women's game, obviously, but why can't I value just the act of playing basketball?
But I think it gets back to... To go back to something I said earlier, it sounds so self-centered to say that, but you know, the thing is, like, there are scouts that are deployed to find black boys who can dunk a ball who are not that tall, or really tall black boys, and there's nowhere near that level of resource investment in finding. No. Like when you look at the NBA and WNBA, I mean, part of why
the industries
I think NBA
are so different.
Well, and NBA, people love to see, you said people, they love to see people dunk, right? They love to see, like, Spud Webb, this 5'6" guy who could do, you know, Michael Jordan was just, like, extraordinary athleticism. And it's not that that's not possible for women, but we work really hard to find those people. I mean, you have scouts go to, like, inner city basketball courts to see, you know, black kids who are not going to be discovered unless they go, I should say black boys, unless they go and find them and then get them into a private school on a scholarship that will cultivate their talent and then get them into a college that will cultivate their talent so they can come in the NBA and bring in a ton of dough. And there's just, that investment is not made for the most part in female athletes. And there's no reason why it couldn't be. Like, that could be invested there. I'm sure there are girls. And, you know, you brought up soccer. Soccer's interesting because in the United States, unlike almost anywhere else in the world, a lot of girls play soccer, right? Like, a lot of girls grow up playing soccer.
But then there's no place for them to go.
Well, although I would say, and I mean, I know this is Olympics, but, like, there was a lot of, I mean, we do know the names of female soccer players in the United
yes,
States.
Yes, we do.
More so than other sports. And that is because, and I don't know the history of this, I don't know why, but, like, soccer is something at the kid level. It probably is a revenue. It was just like, wow, we should be doubling the number of kids playing soccer so for-profit soccer leagues can make more money, and so they brought in girls. Like, that kind of thinking, we need to find a way to get that down the chain in other sports.
You know, I mean, I just think that sports is one of those, like, final frontier spaces where we are just not prepared to abandon our ideas around gender to sort of make that work as a potential revenue stream in the future.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are lots of young girls in the world, and you can lead them towards any sport. and mm-hmm. create and build a market around that. But that is just something that we have struggled to do as a society. And you're right to point out soccer, because soccer is one of those places where we do have female stars. But even that has been really challenging. I mean, we've just now found out. I found out that the women's soccer players are complaining about the kinds of surfaces they're playing on, because people are actually just not spending the right money on them.
That's right.
You know what I mean? I mean, and that belies the fact that women's soccer gets more viewers on TV. So it's not always about revenue generation. You know what I mean? There's actually not the will.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm saying that it's not always dollars and cents. It's like you can end activists on mass. Yeah. You have to push through. There's a resistance.
Right.
Because women's soccer does make more money than men's soccer in the U.S.,
well, what you said about the Williams sisters advocate, it takes, you know, people recognizing the potential or even the status quo sometimes takes activists to connect those dots. And the Williams sisters have been activists, and there others have been. And it probably, and what you're saying, I mean, it's good that women, female soccer players are standing up, because sometimes it takes someone framing the conversation in a way to point out that, like, hey, you're actually making more money here, and so it's in your interest to invest here.
But to recognize that they're making more money and not seeing is it an accident, because that's what happens, and let me just extrapolate, that's what happens with black people in movies.
Yeah.
And women in movies. Mm-hmm. They always assume, remember like that women's comedy that made a ton of money, and you would think, everybody was like, oh, things are going to change. That means we're going to see more bridesmaids.
Yeah, bridesmaids.
But
yeah.
What did they assume about that? That was some weird exception. Wah, wah.
So, well, and it becomes the token, right? The women's comedy.
Which we were able to name.
Actor, you know, the Sammy Davis Jr., like the black person. Like, that's where tokenism comes in. But, you know, we're remaking Ghostbusters and it's going to be female. Yeah, so exactly. that's kind of cool.
And it's going to be one. And then basically, if Ghostbusters suck, I'm going to have to go pay to see it. Because if it doesn't make the money, that's going to be the movie that everything hangs on. You see what I hate about that?
Suck it up. Suck it up, Trisha.
I gotta suck it up and pay for that. Anywho.
That was vigorous. Let's...
I think it was vigorous because I will say I didn't necessarily construct the question quite right, because I didn't even know exactly where I wanted to enter. Mm-hmm. But I think to end this section, what I really wanted to point out is that I think that we all internalize values about male sports mm-hmm. that need to be confronted.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well said.
That even when revenue is happening for women around sports, we come up with reasons why, instead of saying, hey, let's use this as an opportunity to build it more. Yeah. We rationalize it away.
And you're right, we do that in many industries, so I think it's a great
All right, so let's move into recommendations, which is some form of media that you've seen, heard, read, or enjoyed that you think that other people should see, hear, read, or enjoy. And I've been thinking about expanding this segment to where we recommend something and then we like warn people away from another thing.
Like I did last week. That's what I did last week. My anti recommendation.
I was listening back to it last week and I was like, you know, Jason was like way off topic and seized the segment, but it kind of worked. So I will go first since I'm going first today. Batman vs Superman comes out.
Came out last night.
I bought my tickets to see it next week, and me and my friend Danny are going, and we both have been like just sadly anticipating this movie for a long time. The reviews are coming back. I'm just terrible. But there was an article on uprocks.com, which is a thing, and it's all about revisiting Batman Returns, the Michael Keaton, Danny DeVito, Michelle Pfeiffer vehicle of 1992.
The movie that everyone hates except Chris.
Chris. The title of the article is Revisiting Batman Returns, the Weirdest Superhero Movie Ever Made. And in it, he talks about just how the movie takes place in like this Burtonverse where it's basically a love story between these two S&M aficionados who wear leather and fight in dark alleys at night. And so he just goes on about the design of the movie and how just odd it was at the time. But what then he spills into is just how the studio reacted to the movie and how it sort of set up the movies that we're seeing now. How there wasn't enough toyeticness, which is an actual word that was used for these directors. Like the movie wasn't toyetic enough. So they got Joel Schumacher in to do the next two Batman movies.
Oh, awful. And, just awful.
And what's amazing, and because I started with this article and I started looking at documentaries and stuff about the Batman series, is that they actually told Joel Schumacher, we need your movie to be more toyetic, which is a word that's what they used. And they
what does that mean?
They got the toy company on set to consult about
what the Batmobile
should look like, what Batman's devices should look like, sort of what their costumes should look like. Because with Batman Returns, Tim Burton's movie, there was such a backlash from McDonald's and other retailers because they were marketing it for kids and a lot of adults. I don't remember this because I was like so enamored of the movie back in the day.
Which is ridiculous because it was awful.
Okay, well, shut up. And so the problem is that like, people were really upset about the movie. I don't know if you remember, but McDonald's was really pushing it. And people felt like they could not take their kids to see it because of like the sexual overtones, but also because of like Danny DeVito was grotesque and terrifying. So I would recommend that article if you're interested in the Batman series. And even though I haven't seen Batman vs. Superman, my anti-recommendation is don't see Batman vs. Superman. Like, I already sunk my money. I've got to sit through it. Plus, you know, I'm like contractually obligated to see DC properties and Warner Brothers properties. So,
I think Christopher Nolan should sue someone. Like, he had such a good Batman series, and now for this crap. Oh, I'm not seeing it. They're not getting my money.
Well, I'll tell you all about it.
Wonder Woman shows up. I mean, come on. Like, why don't we just wait, bow down to Marvel and say we really wish we had your money?
Wait 1 minute. First
you know,
of all,
that's supposedly getting be the like, best.
If this is going to be the kind of podcast where we say bad things about Wonder Woman, I'm going to hang up right now because that woman, she's a wonder. I love Wonder Woman. What I hear is that in a movie called
she's
Batman
vs.
Superman, Wonder Woman seizes the day. And I'm looking forward to her movie so much. The principal photography that I've seen from it and what people are saying about it, I'm really excited about it.
Well, you know what?
It's got to make money, though, because it's got to make money. That's why it's taking them so long, because if they don't get it right.
I'm not against Wonder Woman. I think an epic battle between Batman and Superman, which then Wonder Woman suddenly appears, just looked...
It's weird.
This is totally based on the trailer. It looks so...
It's dumb.
It just looked like, oh my god, we want Marvel's money. Like, it just was... Oh,
well, why...
It just looked
what? Hello? You know these people are in the business of making money, right?
I
so,
know. But I Christopher mean, Nolan's trilogy made money, and it was smart, and it wasn't... Anyway.
Yeah, look, they're trying to build a bigger universe. Like, I won't defend Warner Brothers for what they're doing, because it's... They're so behind the times, but... Anyway, those are my recommendations. Trisha?
Oh, I haven't consumed any sort of media aside from the radio.
What? I'm sorry. Is it the 1930s?
Yeah. What's the radio? What is that again?
No. I mean, to be honest, I'm gonna recommend the song, which is so old and tells you how behind the time. So I never think about Justin Bieber as a singer. Isn't that weird? Oh, I mean, I know he's a singer.
What's
I know that that's what he's known for.
Right.
I know. I know. I know. And so I've been listening to Justin Bieber's Love Yourself.
Oh, my God.
Why? I'm not understanding. What happened?
I mean, Jason, what's your Stop it. You know me, I'm not really into music. So I was sitting here and I was like, hey, I kind of like this. I can really bop my head to it. So that's like the most sort of new thing I've taken in. Right. Aside from some really heady articles that I could tell you about, right. But I'm just not in the mood.
But you know what I'm talking about, Justin Bieber.
I'm trying to talk about the fact I just realized that Justin Bieber... I know, I'm sorry. I just realized Justin Bieber was a singer of sorts. Because I just never listened to any of his songs.
I'm going to cut this whole point out. Jason, just jump right in.
You're going to do a voiceover. Trisha had to leave suddenly, so she wasn't able to give her recommendation.
That's great.
Jason,
sorry.
You know the title of the segment, Trisha. It's like it's things that you've seen, heard, and enjoyed. Things you think other people should see, hear, and enjoy.
But you know what? Apparently, other people have, because he's like, his albums are make the top 10 Billboard list. I don't know.
Let's move. I'll start by saying I just want to relay that years ago, when Justin Bieber first blew up, I was at a bat mitzvah where he performed, if you can believe that. I didn't even know who he was. Yeah, I didn't even know who he was. And then when I told people who was there, people were like, what? Justin Bieber was there? Oh, my God. So for this segment, I would like to just take a moment to remember Fife Dog from Trap Hopeless. It was just a few weeks ago. I was having a text exchange with a friend, and we were complaining about the lack of talent of Drake and the emotional immaturity of Kanye, and et cetera, et cetera. And I specifically said, I guess not everyone can be a Tribe Called Quest. And she texted back, no, I guess they can't. And then just weeks later, we lose Fife, and it's the 25th anniversary of their first album. And I just think, I am not joking when I say, I think at least once a day, since I first heard that album, I think of the lyric, I'm not fasting, I'm gobbling like a doggone turkey. And Fife's ability at a very young age to write and deliver very poetic, sophisticated lyrics about everyday things, I really think is extraordinary. And he's a great lyricist, but also a great vocalist. I mean, that's the thing about Tribe Called Quest. I feel like prior to them, I mean, there was a lot of great hip-hop, but both Q-Tip and Fife had, like, really great voices. And that's, you know, prior to them, you didn't really talk about that. Like, singers have good voices, but rappers just rap. But, like, Fife had this great voice, great delivery, really poetic. And I don't know, it's sad to see him go at a relatively young age. So that's what I wanted. I recommend all their albums, especially the first one.
This has been a fun East Coast edition of this, actually. We're all on
East
the same
Coast,
time zone.
Saturday morning, yeah.
Yeah, here you go. All right, guys. Well, until next time, take care. Bye,
all
everybody.
Right. See you guys.
Bye.